It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For parents, raising boys to be good men has always been a daunting task. It's only gotten more complicated in the era of social media. Our next guests say it's more important than ever to talk about big issues with boys because you never know what sources they might turn to for guidance instead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have boys of your own, young children, adolescents? Maybe they're grown up now. What were some of the big challenges you encountered in raising them? How do you support them in eventually becoming good adults? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer L.W. Fink is a Wisconsin-based writer, registered nurse, mother of four boys. She co-hosts the podcast On Boys. She's the author of the book Building Boys, Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Christopher Pepper is the author of the Teen Health Today newsletter, co-author of the forthcoming book Talk to Your Boys. He's an award-winning health educator in the San Francisco Unified School District. He helps coordinate there the district's Young Men's Health Project. Christopher, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer, as I mentioned, your subtitle is Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. What do you think that we in the U.S. misunderstand about boys?
I think there's two main things. First of all, I think that many people, myself included, before I had sons, misunderstand the fact that gender affects boys and men's lives too. It sounds naive, but I did not fully realize that boys too are affected and limited by gender stereotypes. And the second thing is people tend to misunderstand male development. And broadly speaking, very broadly speaking, boys' brains and bodies mature more slowly than their female counterparts, which is part of why you can see a big difference between your average 5-year-old boy, 5-year-old girl, 15-year-old boy, and 15-year-old girl.
Christopher, you were once a boy yourself growing up in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. What are some of the challenges that you now find yourself talking to young boys, high school boys in your work?
Yes, I did grow up in Wisconsin, and there's a lot of wonderful things about growing up as a boy. But one of the things that you learn pretty early growing up and is sort of lessons about what it means to be, sometimes you hear this, like, be a man. You hear real clear ideas about what's okay to be, what's okay as far as a way to act as a boy, and what's sort of over the line. So things get pretty restrictive in some ways about how people can talk, what they can be interested in, what they can wear. All those kind of things are pretty prescribed and enforced, and sometimes with bullying, sometimes with teasing, sometimes with violence. And all those things, although there's been some significant change over the last couple generations, all those things are still very present in the minds of boys. They're trying to figure out how to be in the world and really looking for examples of what's okay and what's not okay in the eyes of their peers and the rest of society.
And Jennifer, one really interesting thing and powerful thing I took away from your book is, if you're a parent of a boy, whatever you expect from a boy, maybe whatever you want from a boy, whether that's, matching up what we might think of as a stereotypical boy or breaking those stereotypes, you might not get it. They might end up being very different than you want or expect. And you talk about the idea of acceptance and being ready to, not push back against that, but work with them. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. Parenting is the most humbling experience in the world, I think. So, and so many parents of children of all genders have experienced this. But if you are expecting and thinking that you are going to have a little boy who's going to love trucks and be rough and tumble, and he instead prefers to dance or read or create art, you may be tempted, particularly if you have been affected by societal expectations for boys. Perhaps if you are a dad who maybe had some of the same interests, maybe were bullied, maybe experienced some violence because of that, you might try, out of concern and love for your child, to steer him in more societally acceptable directions.
And
that can come from love, but that can create a lot of conflict and within parent and child relationships and shame and discomfort in the boy.
And Christopher, I want to dive into the theme of your forthcoming book with any kid. It can be, as a parent, tough to have conversations about issues of gender and things that can be difficult conversations. You say that's crucial that we could talk about these things with boys. Tell us how important that is and how we can make those first steps.
Yes. Sometimes people have this idea that boys are not that interested in talking about gender or talking about some kind of substantial issues. The stereotype is that boys only are interested in video games or sports or things like that. My experience is actually that when you can get boys to a place where they're ready to have a conversation, they're very interested in social relationships. They're very interested in talking about gender. They're really curious about how to be a successful man in the world. And I do think that we're sort of leaving a space open where we're not necessarily having those conversations with the boys. And I really want to just encourage parents and teachers and anyone who has boys in their life to have caring conversations with them, to really be coming as a curious listener, hearing what boys have to say, trying to push them a little bit to be a little more expansive in their thinking and stay engaged in conversations. I think there's a lot of conversations that people mean to have. They kind of know, oh, I should probably be talking to my son about that. And they just let it slip by, or they don't have the kind of in-depth conversations that would really be helpful. And I think that's the sort of ultimate purpose of the book that I'm working on, which is called Talk to Your Boys, is to help give tips for families to have those challenging conversations, to actually sit down and say, we need to talk about this. I know it's an awkward thing, but we're going to do it. And to provide some backup and say, yes, you can get through these conversations and the world will be better for you having done it.
We're talking about raising boys to be good adults. Christopher Pepper is with us. His forthcoming book is called Talk to Your Boys. Jennifer Fink, also with us. Her book is called Building Boys, Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, picking up on the point Christopher made about having these conversations, there was an anecdote in your book about dealing with emotion that really stood with me about that connects the idea of meeting boys where they are. A mom, her husband has died, her son's father has died, and she's worried. He doesn't seem to be grieving. All he's doing is playing basketball. And she got some advice. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, this story has stuck with me in the years since I first heard it from a gentleman named Tom Goldman, or Golden, who is a therapist. And the mom expressed her concern to him. And he basically said, hey, go out there and shoot some hoops with him. And the long and short of it was that this boy, he had been trying to perfect, I believe it was his three-pointer, might have been free throws, but he was trying to perfect his shot with his father. And so when his father passed, what looked to the mom like this boy not dealing with his emotions was this boy not only processing his emotions in a very physical way, but remembering and attempting to honor his father by achieving this thing that the two of them had been working on together.
And Christopher, another part of the importance of talking to boys, having these conversations, is if we parents don't, or teachers or others, there's a lot of people on the internet who will, and some of them are just god-awful bad. You think of a self-proclaimed misogynist influencer like Andrew Tate, currently on trial or waiting trial for sex trafficking, kidnapping, and more. There are awful voices out there who are going to fill in the gaps if we don't.
That's exactly right. And I think the way to address that is really with curiosity. Andrew Tate is someone who is very charismatic and has a message for boys. He's trying to explain in his way what it means to be successful in the world. And, you know, that looks like a lot of flashy cars, a lot of women around, a lot of money. And there's not a lot of substance about in his message. And obviously, as you mentioned, like a huge amount of negativity. But the reason, I think that the thing to be curious about is why are boys drawn to that? And I think part of that is because we don't have other people who are kind of saying, hey, here's other ways to be a good man in the world. And he's taking up a lot of that space. So if I were dealing with a kid, and there's a lot of kids who are interested in Andrew Tate and other characters like him, I think the right approach for dealing with that is to be curious, to engage in conversation, and to be really careful to not come in with judgment and just come in and say, this is wrong. I'm going to take your phone if you're looking at that kind of stuff. But to be engaged, you may have to put up with kids looking at some things that you disagree with, but try and be strategic about, okay, I saw my son looking at this. You know, I really don't think this is right, but I want to keep him engaged. I want to keep him close to me and be able to keep talking about these kind of things. So to not come in with a lot of judgment or things that are going to make him feel shamed or go and hide things from you, but to try and do everything you can to keep those avenues of communication open.
Talking to Christopher Pepper, co-author of the upcoming book, Talk to Your Boys, and Jennifer Fink, Wisconsin-based author of the book, Building Boys, looking at how to help boys grow up to be good, well-adjusted people in our modern-day climate. It can be tough in the social media era. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the influence of the internet and social media if you're the parent of boys? Do you see them coming up with stuff? Do you think, where did that come from? Do you have questions about how to open up conversations with boys? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jennifer L.W. Fink, Wisconsin-based author of the book Building Boys, and Christopher Pepper, co-author of the upcoming book Talk to Your Boys, looking at the unique challenges that boys go through growing up and through adolescence, how parents can help guide them through it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If there's something you wish you had heard or a lesson you wish you had known when you were growing up as a boy, love to hear you share that. Also, parents out there, join in with your perspectives or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm coming at this from the perspective of having grown up a boy, but also being a dad. I am a single parent, single father to a daughter. But the reason I'm calling is just that I would say both to raising in terms of raising boys or raising people generally, just that overall to encourage them to listen to perspectives that are different from their own. Just in general. I think Jen earlier had mentioned that she didn't really realize until she had boys that gender roles or gender stereotypes hurt both boys and girls. And, you know, it just sort of reminded me of something that I think a lot of men don't understand about feminism is that feminism teaches us that patriarchy and gender stereotypes hurt everyone, not just women.
Michael, gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, your thoughts on Michael's perspective?
I think that is an excellent point. And it's something that I remind myself of as a mom of sons, too. My sons, who have been growing up, you know, in the 2000s primarily, they don't have the perspective to understand what came before that. They grew up in classrooms that were often female dominated. So they don't understand the history of what happened and why women and girls got extra support. They don't know that in my lifetime, it was first when women could get credit cards in their own name. So we have to help provide context and expose our children to other perspectives.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michael. Christopher, another thing you're an advocate for is not just parents having conversations with boys, but bringing boys together to talk about these kind of things and having boys groups in school. What does that look like? What are some of the benefits?
Yes. I really have seen how powerful it can be to bring small groups of boys together, usually in middle or high school, just to talk about what it's like to be a boy today, to talk about some of the pressures that boys are feeling. And this is something that's been a learning process for me. It was, I kind of at work was told, oh, we want to run these groups. And I was the person that was put in charge of them. I didn't know if they would be successful. And what I've seen is that boys are really interested in having these conversations, and that they want to talk about what they see in the news, what they hear in songs, about how masculinity is kind of playing out on a in their everyday world. And they need help figuring it out. And there's a real space for guided conversations, ideally with a caring adult, a teacher, a social worker, someone who can put some thought and time into this. It's great if we can have men in those leadership roles, either as the facilitator for their group or a co-facilitator with somebody of another gender, and just give them some space to talk about these things, because it really is often something that they're interested in talking about, but does not get space, or they don't have a place in their life to talk about these kind of things. And they're really interested in it. They also really support each other. And I think helping boys make friends and make bonds with one another is something that's really crucial and provides a life skill that will benefit boys for the rest of their lives, and benefit the people that they end up parenting and partnering with later on. If they can get those relationship skills down, it will help them for the rest of their lives.
And Jennifer, it seems like there's a hunger from boys, even through high school, to talk about things like emotions and gender and their experience. But I'm guessing, having been a boy myself, the assumption is that, well, but other boys aren't going to want to talk about that. And well, if I want to fit in, I better not talk about that. Yeah. Is that out there? How do you overcome that?
That is definitely out there. And I think we all need to give our boys some grace. They are learning to have these conversations. They will screw up. And they are living in a society that is still getting used to this idea of males supporting and talking to one another. Often, with especially those middle school boys into high school, often care and concern are expressed in ways that can look like joking and teasing and giving each other a hard time. And it's really helpful if they have adults such as Christopher around to help talk them through kind of what are some of those guidelines? When do you know is it going too far? How do you express care without hurting somebody or putting somebody else down? At the same time, we all can relax a little bit, I think, because generally the boys are trying to figure this out, and they are connecting the best ways they know how in ways that they can, while still kind of preserving their social place. And that's challenging. Anybody who has ever been an adolescent can remember that.
Let's go back to our callers. Kevin is with us in Milwaukee. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about,
Thank
Kevin?
Oh, yes. I'm a deacon at my church, and we deal with boys, teenagers up to 25 years. Matter of fact, we have a group called Boys to Men. Mm-hmm. And basically what we do is pretty much what you're talking about. We show boys about love, understanding. We even bring biblical into it. But to have them understand that not only should they have respect for others, but definitely have respect for their own self, in order to achieve what they want to do. So we just kind of put a lot of things together. In fact, we have a closed door policy where whatever we talk about in the room stays in the room. So that gives them a chance to let loose on the things that they feel. We do have two mentors. If it can get out of hand, you know, we know what to do at that point. But a lot of them happen to have issues where, you know, that they can share with one another. Some might have an issue. One of the other guys might went through that, so he can help that young man go through it himself. So we try to make them bond together as far as age-wise and helping one another.
Kevin, thank you so much for sharing that. Christopher, does that sound like the sort of thing you're talking about doing in schools and elsewhere?
Yes, I really thank you, Kevin, for that comment. I think a lot of boys are just lonely and feel like they're having trouble connecting. Partially this is happening because everybody's got a cell phone, and boys play a lot of video games where they often, you know, have to be at their spot, and they get on their game at their spot. And even if they're playing with friends, their friends are not in the same place. So having a place to connect in real life and get to know people a little on a little bit deeper level is very beneficial. Having some guidance from adults who've been there and having a place for peers to talk to one another, that's really something that a lot of boys would benefit from.
Thanks again for sharing that with us, Kevin. Jennifer, one other big point I took from your book is for everybody else, not the young, not the teenage boys here. You write that a lot of us think of young men as a threat first and foremost, an object of fear. Obviously, that can't be good for them. How do we get over that?
No, it's kind of difficult. And I think it's particularly challenging for those of us who are female, because broadly speaking, men are bigger than us. Men are stronger than us. And many people, male, female, non-binary alike, have been harmed by males. So we have that preconceived notion in our heads. It is up to us to try and recognize that, root it out, challenge it, and make a conscious effort to look at, especially our boys, but also our men, as fellow humans who are in need of care and concern, who need our, they need our empathy and they need our support.
And Christopher, if there are teen boys out there listening, last half a minute, leave us a bit of advice for them to maybe reach out and start these conversations with family and friends.
I think the most beneficial thing that teen boys can do is to really stretch a little bit and be comfortable expressing their emotions, talking about how they're feeling, to really be themselves and let other people in and trust that it's going to be okay. It's going to be, you can be your full self and people will love you and accept you for who you are.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Jennifer L.W. Fink, Wisconsin-based writer, registered nurse, mother of four boys. She co-hosts a podcast called On Boys. She's the author of the book Building Boys, Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. And Christopher Pepper with us, author of the Teen Health Today newsletter, co-author of the upcoming book Talk to Your Boys. We talked to him about unique challenges and pitfalls that boys face during adolescence today and how parents, schools, and others can help. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new state law will require K-12 schools to teach Hmong and Asian American history. We'll look at some of that history and how it could show up in classrooms. First, extreme weather comes to Wisconsin all year round, and between heavy snows and thunderstorms, so do power outages. Those outages can cause problems for anyone. But for those enrolled in the federal food assistance program called SNAP, having a fridge full of food go bad often means going hungry. SNAP recipients can get replacement benefits, but the process isn't easy. While the state has plans to simplify it, that won't happen until after the extreme spring and summer weather season. Eddie Costello reports on the bureaucratic obstacles causing that delay.
With nine grandchildren, food doesn't last long in Lisa Winston's home.
And every day is somebody at the school is somebody. Granny, I'm hungry. Granny, you got something sweet?
The Milwaukee retiree relies on Wisconsin's food share program to stock her kitchen with some of her grandkids' favorite foods, including
macaroni and cheese. They love macaroni and cheese.
But when a winter storm swept across southeast Wisconsin this January, she lost power for over 24 hours, and roughly $200 worth of food in her fridge and freezer spoiled.
And then everybody look at me, I'm hungry, I'm cold. Me too! You know, I don't know what to say. We just eat peanut butter and jelly because you don't know what's good.
The federal government provides replacement benefits for SNAP households that lose food because of things like power outages. But Sherry Tussler, the CEO of the anti-hunger nonprofit Hunger Task Force, says accessing those funds isn't easy.
So you get finally the replacement form and you're like, oh, I could fill it out if it was a fillable form.
But it's not. And unless the state temporarily allows for signatures over the phone, people either have to sign it in person or print it out, then upload it online, mail it, or...
You can fax it to them. How many people you know got a fax machine?
So why can't people just sign it electronically? States need approval from the USDA to accept electronic signatures on replacement forms. And even though Wisconsin got that approval in November 2023, they don't plan on making the option available until October of this year. A spokesperson for the health department says it takes time to change their systems, and they want to make sure no one's benefits are disrupted. But the agency has accepted other forms with electronic signatures for over a decade. and the delay means the online form won't be available until after tornado season.
With climate change, these storms are becoming as detrimental to households as the hurricanes that you'll see in Florida.
Melissa Kandari is the Midwest Regional SNAP Director. She says preparing for extreme weather has become a bigger priority for SNAP agencies in the region. But even once online signatures are available, an even bigger problem will remain. Many recipients just don't know that replacement benefits exist.
This is the case in every state that I've seen, where it's just not widely known.
But Tussler wonders why any form, fillable or not, is necessary after major outages. She says the state can see who lost power and who already spent their food share benefits for the month, and they could use that data to automatically replace people's benefits,
rather than putting them through some kind of unnatural gauntlet of paperwork.
The USDA does allow states to issue mass replacements. There are strict guidelines, so most states only issue mass replacements during declared disasters. But Wisconsin hasn't issued mass replacement benefits in at least 15 years.
If you got a power outage that blows through, you know, like 10,000 households went without power, it's probably time to trigger it.
An estimated 127,000 SNAP households were potentially affected by January's ice storm, including Lisa Winston's. And despite receiving food assistance for almost a year, she didn't learn about replacement benefits until her friend saw a news report about how Hunger Task Force was helping affected residents.
I'm like, wow, I never know all the sources out here to help people, you know, that's really, really in need.
She spent her last $2 taking the bus to sign the paperwork. But for Winston, it was worth it. About 2 weeks later, she got enough assistance to buy her grandkids fresh food and milk for their mac and cheese. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Governor Evers signed a bill into law on Thursday that will require K-12 schools in Wisconsin to teach Hmong and Asian American history. Wisconsin already requires some form of Black, Native American, and Hispanic American history in schools. The addition of Hmong and Asian American history comes after a spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans during the height of the pandemic. We're talking about this new requirement to teach Asian and Hmong American history in Wisconsin schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this history your history? Are you glad to see it showing up in schools? If you're a teacher, how are you looking at the new guidelines and requirements? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brenda Yang serves District 19 on the Dane County Board of Supervisors. She's a graduate student at UW-Madison in the School of Education, studying cultural identity and its significance in public schools. Brenda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
This law has been floated a couple times in the past, passed this time around, now signed into law. What's your reaction to it making it past the finish line this time?
You know, this bill was first introduced on the floor in about 2006, so by Representative Shanklin. So the bill has been in existence for almost 20 years. So, and the thing that I find that's incredibly fitting about this is that the person who ended up signing this bill is a former educator. So, and I've always believed that a lot of the solutions to what ails society can be found in education in our public schools. So it's pretty unprecedented, in my opinion.
So from a student perspective, under this new law, what are they going to see through their coursework?
Yeah, you know, I think my understanding of it is there are current laws that already exist in Wisconsin that have mandate to teach Black and Hispanic history. Mm-hmm. So this would just add in the component of Asian American voices to that requirement, and specifically Hmong American narratives. And so how they choose to teach that and implement that is up to each school district and each up to each school and how they want to mandate that specifically in implementation steps or practices.
Can you talk about Hmong American students in particular? They've accounted for the rise overall in Asian American residents here in Wisconsin. How important do you see this kind of education being for them and their school experience?
You know, I think as far as the implications of this bill, I think it's incredibly unprecedented. According to my understanding, there is no bill that exists at this caliber of direct and intentionality in creating visibility for a certain people group, specifically the Hmong community. So this will have huge social impact implications because of its intentionality. There are current state laws out there that have a similar mandate to include the voices of Asian Americans, but not quite as specific as this bill. Even in the state of Minnesota, which has the largest Hmong population, and the state of California, which has the second largest Hmong population, they don't have educational mandates that are this specific. So this is pretty unprecedented. The state of Wisconsin is the third largest Hmong population. And the fact that we are this law passed and is being included in educational curriculum is very significant. And it means a lot to our community. But I think there are larger, more social impact implications than people realize.
Oh, what are some of those wider implications?
Yeah, so in regards to social impact, first, I think it's going to help dispel a lot of myths and stereotypes that exist in Asian American communities, especially that we are a monolith. And so we are not a monolith, and this narrative has actually caused harm and prevented access to specific Asian groups like the Hmong people, because when we are lumped into one category, we all have very unique and complex stories with unique challenges. So this bill will help us to better understand the challenges and nuances that exist to eliminating barriers and creating access for specific communities. Also, it'll open the door for not only Hmong people to feel a sense of belonging, but that we exist and we matter. And it also allow people to process sort of their own cultural and historical identities and how that relates to the larger American historical context in an educational and very public setting.
One unfortunate part of our landscape in the United States right now that may have helped push this bill over the top is, as I mentioned earlier, a rise in reports of hate crimes targeting Asian Americans, largely coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Are you watching that? Are you hoping things get better? Can something as simple as talking about Hmong American identity in classrooms help tackle that sort of thing?
I believe that it can, because when you're intentional and you're creating pathways where traditional stories or traditional or different narratives have not existed before, it'll open up for space for those discussions to exist and create a sense of not just belonging for that specific people group, but acceptance of cultural identity in general. And I think Americans, the larger problem that we have is we know that we have ignorance. All of us have ignorance. But the problem is we are very apathetic in wanting to learn. So when we create a mandate that requires people to actually open up their understanding of different people groups, that opens up the door to create different spaces that haven't existed before. And so I truly believe that cultural identity is the key to solving a lot of the social issues we see in our society today. Because when we have a firm understanding of where we come from, where our ancestral roots derive from, our cultural traditions and practices, why we practice them, I think this is fundamental to a student's understanding of how they perceive themselves and the world around them, which is also directly connected to the impact of mental health. And research has also shown us that those who have a firm understanding of their cultural identity are more likely to not only advocate for themselves, but for other people groups as well, which will help with creating a more informed and human-centered society. And I think that's the goal.
Brenda Yang is with us. Brenda serves as Dane County Board Supervisor and studies cultural identity in public schools at UW-Madison. We're talking about a new state law that requires some Asian and Hmong American history to be taught in Wisconsin schools. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this law? How much do you think knowledge of this kind of history affects a person's understanding of the people they share the state with? Are you Asian American or Hmong American yourself? Maybe a student? What are your thoughts on this idea? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about a bill Governor Evers signed into law last week that had passed the legislature to require K through 12 schools to teach Hmong and Asian American history. Brenda Yang is with us. She studies cultural identity issues in education at UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in schools, are you already sharing some of these stories? If you're part of the Hmong American community here in Wisconsin, what stories do you want heard and told in schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Brenda, you are, I understand, a first-generation Hmong immigrant yourself. You work with community leaders on issues that affect Hmong students in public schools. Can you tell us some about that work and maybe challenges that Hmong students, Hmong American students, face?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've been doing a lot of work in the community in regards to education specifically. I used to serve on the board for a nonprofit that created a program in Dane County, the Hmong Institute, that created a program called the Hmong Learning Cultural Enrichment Program. And we helped shape that program. It's been in existence for a long time in Dane County. And what we wanted to do with that was to pretty much see if we were able to create an environment where students can study their history, their cultural identity, the foods that that are a part of their ethnic heritage, and also to plant some of the plants and crops that exist in our identity, that creates this sort of holistic kind of all encompassing environment for students from K-4 to eighth grade. And what we've learned from that is that we realize that all of our students who have been in the program, we studied data like 3 years before and 3 years after to see if there has been a significant improvement in learning capacities, assessment scores, attendance. And we noticed that there is significant shift in students who are in that program and their sense of belonging, wanting to go to school, and their sense of understanding who they are, and their sense of learning as well. And also having the confidence to pass tests or, you know, to write in their own sort of kind of unique perspective. So we know and we understand from a psychological perspective that being recognized and valued and seen as worthy has huge psychological implications. And so I think that is similar in this case. But in that when you study cultural identity, it's a little bit more nuanced because there's a lot of that historical component that plays into that, because specifically with Hmong people, our diaspora is very has been in existence for a long, long time. And it was around 300 AD that Hmong people used to live in the northern parts of China, but we were moved by the Chinese rulers at that time, and then we migrated to the southern parts of China. So millions of Hmong people to this day still live in the southern parts of China. But then in addition to that, we migrated to Vietnam and Laos. And then that's how we came to the States, was our involvement in the Vietnam War, also known as the Secret War.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Yes, I just have a question about a comment that was made a few minutes ago in relation to an increase in Asian hate. And how should, you know, schools handle that and educate people that you shouldn't really hate anybody? But when you look at the statistics from the FBI and you look at the crimes, most of the crimes per capita are really perpetrated by people of African-American descent. So how would you, you know, break that down to distill to kids where that hate is coming from, as opposed to making a global statement of Asian hate?
Steve, thanks for the call. I'm looking at the FBI stats. Just in general, hate crimes mostly committed by white people. That's not a surprise. That's most of the population. But Brenda, regardless of that point, I think your hope is that these classes will serve all groups in hoping to prevent anti-Asian hate.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the goal and that's the hope. It's not just, but I think it's also important to recognize the nuances of hate that exists within BIPOC groups, right? And I think that, the African-American community and the Asian community actually have a very long history of a conflict that exists in our stories. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge that and to recognize that. And I think to dispel a lot of that, those myths and that hate, we have to do it with education. We have to do it with information. We have to do it with kindness and empathy, obviously, and understanding why people feel that certain way that they do, and helping to inform them and change the way they perceive us, the way they perceive themselves. And I think, to be honest, when people show hate, that's more of a reflection on them more than it is a reflection on that people group per se.
Thanks for that call. Brenda, what are some of the stories you hope people will hear, students, and I guess the rest of us will hear about the Hmong experience coming to the United States? It shares many things in common with many immigrants, but as you were saying earlier, some very unique parts of that story as well.
Yeah, you know, one thing that that I'm finding out in a lot of my studies is that the impact in academia, in higher education, I don't think people talk about that a lot. I think that this bill will actually help shape and influence more people into majoring in Asian American studies, specifically Hmong American history, which I think impacts and shapes career trajectories and employment, eventually maybe even our economy. But currently there are not many scholars who are majoring in Asian American studies, let alone Hmong American studies. And so because of this, there is a huge deficit in historical accuracy and research. And so Hmong American history is so vast, nuanced, and complex that there are facets of it that have yet to be explored. For example, the historical narratives of Hmong Christian voices, no one is capturing that information right now. So incorporating these voices into curricula will help shape the landscape of not just social impact, but also academia and career trajectories, career development in history, sociology, psychology, religion, and many other disciplines as well.
Well, that makes me wonder, since it sounds like the state isn't saying, okay, here's exactly the curriculum to teach. Yeah. If I'm in charge in a school district of figuring out what that curriculum is going to look like, that sounds like a tough job. How do you suggest somebody get started and figure out how to capture this amazing diversity of experiences among Americans?
Yeah, you know, that is a very tough job because, like I said, there is a lack of scholars in this specific area. I think this will help create the economy for that, create sort of this niche for people who want to major in this and look more into this. There are obviously Hmong scholars who exist who are studying the impact of that, like Dr. Yan Shao, who was here at UW, and Dr. Tia at UW Milwaukee, who's doing wonderful work in this. But like I said, our story is so vast that we need more people. We need more people to get into academia, to study this and the importance of it. And I think it'll start with that. Unfortunately, school districts are going to have a hard time in finding data or, you know, facts that are actually historically accurate, because there is yet to create a platform for where scholars who exist, who are experts and are already have years and years of study in this. And so I think it will create that. And then the challenge is really to be able to find curriculum that is nuanced and is complex and is holistic understanding of the vast history and the complexities of our identities and where we come from. I hope that answers your question. I know that's
it's a big question. But, yeah. It just yeah. Our last few moments, just less than half a minute, Brenda, how important is it for students of any background to see at least a little bit their history, their identity reflected in what they're studying?
I think it is significant to be able to go into a classroom and recognize that your history is being taught is the most powerful form of belonging and creating inclusion. And I think if we want to mirror that in our society, we really have to start with the classroom in our public schools and creating and setting the precedent for the next generation to create spaces where all of us are seen, all of us, our voices are valued, and we are all heard. And I think, like I said, this is unprecedented because this will help to create that possibly. And I, like I said, the implementations of this are yet to still to be discussed, and it's left up to the school district. So there's a lot of autonomy in how they choose to carry this out. So it'd be really interesting to actually study this before and after as well, the implications of this and cultural identity. And what does that?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Brenda Yang. Brenda studies cultural identity in public schools at UW-Madison. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a spring classical music preview. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. If the eclipse wasn't a cool enough natural event for you, stay tuned for a few weeks for the great cicada cycle of 2024. You may have seen this. Two broods of these cicadas will line up this year, one that comes out every 13 years, one that comes out every 17 years. As reported in the New York Times, something on the order of a trillion cicadas will wake up for a brief life cycle. Two big questions. A, will Wisconsin see them? Answer, yes, in the southern part of the state, probably starting in a few weeks. And two, can you eat them? Answer, yes, with an asterisk. I looked up advice for the last big brood of cicadas. They are edible for humans, but you should cook them, handle them pretty much like you would raw meat for food safety reasons. They can carry germs. There are recipes online. If you have a shellfish allergy, steer clear. It can trigger them. If you're pregnant or nursing, steer clear. They can accumulate some mercury. Otherwise, bug appetit. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Sunday's NCAA Women's Championship game between Iowa and South Carolina drew a peak audience of 24 million viewers, according to Nielsen, making it the most watched basketball game since 2019. To be clear, not the most watched women's basketball game or the most watched college basketball game in that time period, the most watched basketball game since 2019. Women's sports have been gaining in things like popularity, advertising revenue, and ticket sales, led in part by a World Cup soccer dynasty. This season, a group of high-profile stars drew attention to the women's basketball tournament, led by Caitlin Clark, Iowa's record-breaking point guard, and also including Paige Beckers, Angel Reese, Cameron Brink, and Camilla Cardoso. We're going to talk about their contributions to women's basketball and women's sports, the ratings, and where all the excitement goes from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch any of the NCAA women's tournament games on TV or maybe in person? How about the men's games? Have you noticed a change in coverage of the women's tournament? Have you noticed coverage of the women's tournament? Have you followed Caitlin Clark this year? What do you think she's done or means for women's sports? Do you have a young athlete in your family? Are they paying attention? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Jo Kane is Professor Emerita in the College of Education and Human Development and Founder and Director Emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. Mary Jo, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me. And boy, have you hit on all the key questions and issues.
Mary Jo, you've been following women's sports for a good while now. What did this NCAA women's basketball tournament mean for women's sports?
Well, I keep saying this over the last several years, and certainly since the 50th anniversary of Title IX in 2022, but I really think that this has taken us to a new stratospheric era, in that we finally have, I think, a critical mass of, first of all, great athletes, great competitors, superstars, supernovas, really, when you talk about somebody like Caitlin Clark. And you have a critical mass of people who are audience members, male and female. And I think finally a critical mass of both TV that finally gets it, mass media, and of course corporate sponsorship. We have never been here before.
Let's talk a little more about Iowa's Caitlin Clark. Now, fell short ultimately in the finals to South Carolina. Here's the South Carolina head coach, though, Dawn Staley, talking about her opponent here, Caitlin Clark.
And I want to personally thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport, and it just is not going to stop here on the collegiate tour. But when she is the number one pick in the WNBA draft, she's gonna lift that league up as well. So Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you are one of the GOATs of our games, and we appreciate you.
Can we put too much stress on one name? How big a deal was Caitlin Clark's college career, now over, headed to the pros, as we just heard there? How big a deal was her career in generating excitement for the sport?
Unique, unprecedented. You know, I've talked with others where I talk about how she's not just great for women's basketball, for all of women's sports, and frankly, men's basketball as well. And a retort that I will often get is that, well, what you're saying, Dr. Kane, is that a rising tide lifts all boats. And my response to that is, that's true. But in Caitlin Clark's case, she's not just a rising tide. She is a tsunami of influence and a tsunami of impact.
That said, she had good players to play against. She had an amazing incoming class, and people are looking forward to her competitions, maybe against Angel Reese and others when they all go pro. The fact is, the caliber of players, not just Caitlin Clark, seems to be going up and up and up.
Yes, with every, I think, again, one of the great things that has happened two generations removed from Title IX in 1972 is that young girls today, for the first time ever in our history, grow up with a sense of entitlement to playing sports. They have access to scholarships. They have access to great coaching, conditioning, facilities, competition at a very early age. And they're not used to or willing to settle for hand-me-downs. So every generation, we get bigger, stronger, faster, better. And I think the other thing about Caitlin Clark is she's a winner. And that's what Americans love. When the brightest light on the biggest stage under the greatest amount of tension and stress, Caitlin Clark wants the ball. And Caitlin Clark, for the most part, has delivered.
She delivered, women's sports delivered. There have been concerns about the NCAA and others not delivering back, a bit of a fiasco, right, when the three-point lines in a series of the games at one of the arenas were different than each other, which is not really how you're supposed to play basketball. We hear, we see Olympic training facilities very different from men's and women's sports. Are, even as the women get the success and get the eyeballs on the TV screens, are they getting the respect from their own organizations?
Well, they're certainly getting more respect than they used to. But what's great about what's happened now, and I think this is why I go back to the first time ever, young women today grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports. Mm-hmm. And you certainly saw this with Megan Rapinoe and the women's soccer team with the Women's World Cup. Whenever an organization like the NCAA falls short, the response is not, well, don't complain, don't cause trouble, be happy for what we have. The reaction is instantaneous, and it's really, frankly, moral outrage to say, this is not acceptable. The other thing that's happening now that's never happened before, which is why I think we're at an unprecedented moment, speaking of protesting, is that female athletes take to social media to let the world, and certainly the NCAA, know their displeasure, and they embarrass and frankly shame the NCAA into saying, we will do better.
Mary Jo Kane is with us from the University of Minnesota and the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport, looking at a rise of women's and girl in sport. The latest big example, the NCAA women's basketball bracket, the championship, the most viewed basketball game of all basketball games since 2019. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a longtime fan of women's college basketball or women's soccer, or you fill in the sport there? Or did you jump in this last season, maybe just this tournament? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Looking a little more at Caitlin Clark, the Iowa star, and her impact on the game. Here is her talking after the championship game loss about a question about her impact on women's basketball.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, it's really hard to win these things. I think I probably know that better than most people by now. And to be so close twice, it definitely hurts. But at the same time, we were right there. We battled. We took down some really great teams to get back to this point, and something that's really hard to do. And You know, I think when I think about women's basketball going forward, you know, obviously it's just going to continue to grow, whether it's at the WNBA level, whether it's at the college level. Like, everybody sees it, everybody knows, everybody sees the viewership numbers. When you're given an opportunity, women's sports just kind of thrives. And I think that's been the coolest part for me on this journey is just, you know, we start our season playing in front of 55,000 people in Kinnick Stadium, and now we're ending it probably playing in front of 15 million people or more on TV. You know, it just continues to get better and better and better, and that's never going to stop. You know, when you continue to give them the platform, like, this, things like this are just going to continue to happen.
And Mary Jo, we've seen this at the college women's basketball level. What are you looking at the in the WNBA, especially as this this crop of amazing athletes goes pro?
Well, I think the WNBA is well positioned to accept Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and all the other fabulous women athletes who we know now know as household names who will go into the WNBA. I already know, you know, here in Minneapolis, we have the Minnesota Lynx who have won four WNBA titles. And I'm already hearing from friends and colleagues saying, when's Caitlin Clark going to be here? When's the Indiana Fever going to be here? Because people want to see Caitlin Clark. I just don't think that this is going to be a once every 4 year phenomenon like the Olympics is often been the case. I really do think we are at a sea change and a unique moment in women's sports. And one other sort of quick thing here about Caitlin Clark, not only is she a great competitor and a winner, but as you could tell from her remarks, she clearly feels a great responsibility and has handled it well, which is something that Dawn Staley was referring to. She has carried this burden well. She has been a spectacular ambassador for women's sports, not just with little girls, but with little boys as well. She's a role model, and she is one class act.
We're talking about the women's NCAA basketball championships. Iowa's outgoing star Caitlin Clark now going pro. What it all means for the rise of women's sports in America after record-breaking viewership for the final game. Our guest is Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita in the College of Education and Human Development and Founder and Director Emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. You could join in now at 800-642-1234. Are you connected to women's sports as an athlete or former athlete yourself, a coach? Did you watch a lot of the women's basketball tournament this year, or do you follow other women's team sports at the college level, the pro level, you name it? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita in the School of Kinesiology and Director Emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota, talking about the rise in prominence and star power in women's sports. In particular, Caitlin Clark from Iowa and the NCAA Women's Basketball Championships that just wrapped up over the weekend with record viewership. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Jo, I think I've asked you about this in the past, kind of a chicken or egg question. Media outlets say, well, we don't want to cover a lot of women's sports because nobody watches it, but then maybe nobody was watching women's sports because nobody was covering it and they didn't have it available to them on TVs. Have we broken out of that cycle?
Well, I certainly hope so. And, you know, one of the things that those of us like myself, who was a faculty member for 30-some years at the University of Minnesota and whose research focus often was on media coverage of women's sports, and you're right, it was, we heard this over and over again, that nobody's interested in women's sports. And my retort often was, well, how do you know that? You never let us see it or you never write about it. And what I think that this has really shown is that there is this vast, untapped, hungry, enthusiastic audience, again, to see not just women's sports because it's a feel-good kind of thing, but because you are looking at fabulously talented, dedicated, disciplined, committed athletes. And I think that, you know, corporate America has also noticed, finally, and they're not doing this out of an altruistic streak. They're doing it because they realize because of such an audience and interest and such passion and commitment to women's sports that it is a tremendous investment for their brand. And speaking of Caitlin Clark, I would argue that the behemoth of sports advertising in this country, State Farm Insurance, signed Caitlin Clark, and she is the first college player, male or female, to ever be signed by State Farm. So their investments are being returned many times over because of the interest and the compassion and the staying power of superstars like Caitlin Clark.
Now, soccer, women's soccer had a big run there with the success of the U.S. team. Now the world's getting a little more competitive. We have this big moment in women's college basketball. What sports do you have your eyes on next, Mary Jo?
Well, I think basketball and soccer will continue to grow. I think volleyball is really popular, certainly at the University of Minnesota and at the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. hockey in the upper Midwest is very big. Softball, you know, you can never count out softball. Again, I think what those of us who have toiled in the fields for a long time in terms of caring about women's sports is we have said for decades now, build them a ballpark and they will come, and they have in overwhelming numbers. You know, and I would also talk about, again, 2 years removed from the 50th anniversary of Title IX. I was often asked what the impact of that federal law has been. And, you know, I grew up in central Illinois in the 50s and 60s. I was a tomboy. There weren't sports at all for me. But the difference because of Title IX is that in two generations, we've gone from young girls like me hoping there is a team to young girls all over this country hoping that they make the team, whether it's, you know, basketball, soccer, hockey, whatever. They have opportunities and scholarships as long as they're willing to pay the price and as long as they're good athletes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ellen is with us in Milwaukee. Ellen, hello.
Hi, thanks, Mary Jo. I just want to echo what you just said. This is a very personal celebration for me. I grew up as an excellent athlete in the 50s. There was nothing for me to do. My daughter was a professional women's football player. We had to have bake sales. There was no equipment, but the women were excellent, disciplined athletes. And I'm just celebrating this on a personal and a larger level.
Ellen, thank you so much for sharing that story. Mary Jo.
Yeah, I hear this all the time, Rob, from Ellen in Milwaukee, all across the country, whether I'm in person or on the radio or television. There are, you know, lost generations of young women who care deeply about sports, but just did not have the opportunity. And what I love about that is that I don't hear bitterness. I hear, like Ellen just suggested, a celebration of what this moment in time means. And it's been a long time coming, but it's just so wonderful to witness.
Ellen, thanks for that call. Dwayne is with us now in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I was kind of curious. I mean, do you remember the night when the boys went to war, and it was around the 1940s when there was no baseball and they had the women fill in? So you've even got the Hall of Fame. And his question is that, unfortunately, that was starting to take off, and then all of a sudden they stopped it, but they never had a resurgence in it. So what do they think that if they can get the resurgence back now than prefer then?
Dwayne, thanks for the call. Mary Jo, I assume you're fairly familiar with that story.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt there, Dwayne. You're talking about the All-American Girls Baseball League, which was memorialized and became very popular in the Penny Marshall movie with Tom Hanks and Gina Davis and Rosie O'Donnell. Yes, it did happen because of the men going off to war. But Dwayne's right. After the war was over, it basically just sort of petered out. I don't know that we'd have baseball coming back, but softball is tremendously popular. I don't have the exact statistics, Rob, but I think perhaps right behind college basketball, college softball might be one of the most popular sports that there is. I know they get all kinds of great ratings when they're on television. So softball, it seems to be where we are right now.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Jo Kane with the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. Mary Jo, not every kid, boy or girl, who goes into sports, say at elementary school or middle school, is going to go on to play in college or pros. What does this mean for them? Do you see this maybe getting valuable athletic experience, team building experience for kids, even the ones we're not going to, you know, see on the sports pages in 15 years?
Oh, yeah. Sports is one of the very best activities that young people can be involved in. It gives you a sense of self-respect and discipline and teamwork, a sense of identity where you are part of something. If you're playing team sports, obviously, in particular, where you're part of a much bigger whole. And I know this may seem trite, but the life lessons one learns in sports always carries over into the rest of your life. And so, you know, if you're somebody who works in the business world and you want to hire somebody, I know lots of folks at the upper echelons of business always look to see, well, what kind of sports background do you have? Because those folks know either from their own experience or from seeing the fruits of what sports can do, is that if you have the discipline and the respect and the time management and the commitment and the passion, that all of those things that you learn in sports, those will carry over into the workforce. And it's just a great investment for this country.
Now, I imagine, Mary Jo, speaking of the business world, a lot of people in maybe sports media and networks, and as you mentioned earlier, advertisers may be looking at what just happened with the NCAA Women's Tournament and thinking, hey, maybe we should be doing something. What are you watching for from the money side of things when it comes to women's sports?
Well, I think the money and the investment is just going to grow and grow. You know, Lisa Bluter, the coach of Iowa, talks about Caitlinomics and the economic effect of Caitlin Clark. And that, you know, for example, she came to the University of Minnesota in the last, one of the last games here at the Barn. I'm sure a lot of your WPR listeners maybe have even been to the Barn at the University of Minnesota. It was sold out. Every away game this year that Iowa played was sold out. You already talked about in your intro, Rob, about all of the attendance records and all the viewership records that have broken. And it just becomes this symbiotic relationship where you invest more and then you see a return on that investment and you just keep going and going. So I really do think that the sky is the limit to see women's sport as a great investment, both literally and figuratively. And again, I think we are just at this real inflection point in the history of women's sports.
And we'll leave it there. Mary Jo, thanks for joining us again.
And thanks, as always, for inviting me, and you take care.
You too. That's Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita in the College of Education and Human Development and Founder, Director Emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. We talked to her today about the Women's NCAA Basketball Championships that just wrapped up and what it all means for women's sports. You can keep sharing your stories, maybe what this means for you or someone in your family. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Amazon makes a lot of revenue. That's no secret. But are they using their massive market power to get extra money out of consumers and vendors? We'll dig into the company's bottom line, what it all means for you. And women saw gains in the U.S. economy over decades. Now they may be falling behind. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Women, Money, Power, The Rise and Fall of Economic Equality, tomorrow on Central Time.